Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. You know how we start the show? We start it about 4 minutes after the hour live, and here we are. Nehemiah 8:10 says, "The joy of the Lord is my strength. The joy of the Lord is my strength." Let's focus on that today a little bit. Let's tweet that out. Here's a piece of news. Women wanting to end their pregnancy in Missouri will now have to wait 3 days before they can get an abortion. A judge yesterday refused to stop a new state law that requires doctors to give women information about their abortion. Then let them think about it for 72 hours. Planned Parenthood officials in the state are, of course, decrying the decision. And I read an article that George Will wrote. It's a very short one. I'm going to give you the majority of it. Whether a 20-week fetus has neurological pathways sufficient for feeling pain is surely a question that science can answer, if it has not already. Already, there are myriad intrauterine medical procedures, some involving anesthesia. Doctors can heal lives that America's extremely permissive abortion law says can be terminated with impunity. Only 7 nations allow unrestricted abortion after 20 weeks. Most European nations restrict abortions by at least week 13. France and Germany are very restrictive after 12, Sweden after 18. Getting a scientific answer to the pain question, even if it is yes, should gratify the party of science. If the answer is yes, those who think fetal suffering is irrelevant can explain why they do. Way to go, George Will. All right, we've got a great hour coming up. We've got Ben Johnson already, I think, on our studio line from the Acton Institute. We're going to talk about Richard Thaler, the gentleman who just won a major award for his study of economics. I think it was a Nobel Prize of some kind. I have none of those on my mantle at home, which is just an aside, if you didn't already know that about me. I have none of those prizes on my mantle. We're going to take a break, though. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ben, and then we also have in the second part of the hour, we're going to talk to Ron Deal from Family Life Blended. Be back in a minute. We are back. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Richard Thaler was the co-author of Nudge. It's won the Nobel Prize for his contributions to behavioral economics. We're going to talk about that with Ben Johnson, from the senior editor of the Acton Institute. He will help us process that. Ben, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks. Good to be with you, Bill.
Thank you. Let's talk about first how we would spend the $1.1 million in prize money. I would get a flat screen TV. What about you?
I would make a big donation to My Faith Radio.
You are so much nicer than me. Everyone's raising and pumping their arms here in the studio. You've said the right thing, Ben. Thanks so much. All right, let's talk about Richard Thaler, the co-author of The Nudge, and this has won the Nobel Prize for his contributions to behavioral economics. What does all that mean?
Yeah. Thaler, as you mentioned, was the co-author of the book Nudge with Cass Sunstein, who was Barack Obama's regulatory czar. He's better known probably to most of your listeners. But Thaler had a somewhat similar role under David Cameron in 2010, helping to set up what are called Nudge units in the UK government. Thaler had the insight, along with Sunstein, that if you want people to change their behavior, economics can help you do that. So rather than ban a behavior, you could simply raise taxes, and you can tax people to the point that the cost will be too high for them to continue to engage in that. So if you want to, you want fewer people to smoke, you don't have to ban tobacco. Simply raise the taxes to the point that the price will be prohibitive per pack, or similar. He's favored similar taxes for alcohol, sugary snacks, fast food, fossil fuel use, things of that sort. And so these nudge units in the government have begun encoding these insights into policy. But this year he won the Nobel Prize for Economics, of course, the highest prize that you can win from your colleagues and scholars in economics. And so you see his work at hand all over the place. Every time you go to a gas pump, in my state at any rate, there's a sticker there that tells you how much of that is tax, and people are trying to raise that here. In the UK, again, where he had a more direct role in the government policy, there was a direct move under David Cameron to try and move people away from regular gasoline to diesel fuel because they thought that that was better for the environment. So there were heavy economic penalties and incentives to switch to diesel. They then found out that diesel doesn't release as much carbon, but it releases 52 other gases that science now says is against harmful to the environment. So now they're trying to get people out of diesel, and they're considering applying the same sort of economic disincentives to get people away from diesel, which they just switched to hybrid cars. So these are the sorts of insights that Thaler's known for, is moving people through economic policy to whatever means the government believes is best for them.
Mm-hmm. Ben, does this not affect the less prosperous families the most? These kinds
absolutely.
Of policies?
Those with the absolutely. Those with the least economic resources are the most influenced by this. The rich always have the ability to consume within limits, of course, but they have the ability to pay more for alcohol, cigarettes, but also things like fossil fuels. That's why you see people like Al Gore jetting off to environmental conferences to tell people not to use gasoline. They always have the ability to overcome this. It always falls hardest on working families. For example, there was a conservative politician in the UK who had seen a parking facility, and he noticed that there was a sign to charge people staying there overnight, and he found out people were parking halfway between where they lived and in London because they couldn't afford enough gasoline to go home at night. So every night they slept in their cars because the diesel was too expensive for them to even make the trip all the way from one commuter point to the other. So you're right. It absolutely has the biggest effect on low-income families. But these sorts of taxes and government policies and economic incentives, despite the best of intentions, they always have unintended consequences, which in some cases are incredibly harmful to families, or in some cases even end up benefiting economic actors like gangsters and terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Ben, let me ask you this, because with like electric cars, you take like the Chevy Volt, which had a pretty pricey sticker on it. And of course, that was the car that, you know, the Obama administration wanted everyone to get all excited about, of which nobody did. But it was a very expensive car. And then there was like a $7,500 tax break. So in other words, the government is in a way helping rich people buy electric cars.
That's right. And as you pointed out, you know, the poor people are the ones who end up really paying for this because they can't afford the cars that they were realistically within their price range. On the other hand, people who are more inclined to buy this and would have the means to do so, that is wealthy families, the well-to-do and the upper middle class, now get a government incentive to indulge in the kind of behavior that they wanted to in the first place. So, yeah, it's a perverse use of economic incentives. But I noted, I spoke about this a little bit in two of the articles that I wrote for the Acton Institute. There's that aspect. There's also the fact that the real beneficiaries of a lot of these taxes are terrorists and organized gangsters. So, for example, during Prohibition, of course, we remember that it was Al Capone and people like that who were running alcohol. But around the world, you know, people with the best of intentions want to tax cigarettes. And they have talked about raising cigarette taxes astronomically high. One of the people who is in favor of that is Richard Thaler. They found that the higher that the taxes are raised, the more that terrorists can charge for black market cigarettes. Mm. People, for example, terrorist cells are driving from Richmond, Virginia, or Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, up to New York City, where Mayor Bloomberg's made cigarettes, I think, $13 a pack. And they're able to make a massive amount of money by filling up a van full of cigarettes where they can purchase them legally, selling them illegally. And one French think tank found that they'd surveyed 15 different international terrorist organizations. they found 20% of their funding comes from the illegal sale of tobacco and cigarettes around the world. So if you think of one of five terrorists in the world, they were funded in due in part to cigarette taxes that are too high. I have no brief for smoking. I think that it's incredibly harmful. In fact, I think there are spiritual dimensions that people should not smoke or drink or become addicted to any substance. However, we have to think of the best way to deal with that. And the best way, I think, is through people like pastors and others in the church and family members begging and pleading and doing everything that we can and praying for people to stop and exerting the influence we have, not the government nickel and diming people to death. It's also been concluded that for the most part, these are ineffective. So they're not only do they help terrorists, but they don't really help the people they're intended to help.
Yeah. Ben, let's take a break. When I come back, I want to talk about these economic policies and continue to talk about exactly what you were saying about the sin taxes and how it's affecting and benefiting terrorism. I want to continue that conversation. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Speaking to Ben Johnson, senior editor of the Acton Institute. Be right back.
And when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's a sunny day.
It is 18 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Ben Johnson, senior editor of the Acton Institute. Ben, don't we feel a little bit foolish when we find out that those unintended consequences are empowering the terrorists?
Well, I think we should definitely, it should make us rethink our policy, to say the least. Again, the problem with American policy, especially when it comes to economics, is that everything is judged by the intention. Nothing is judged by the outcome. So people say we want to help the environment. We'll tax carbon fuel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize that this has an impact on people. They're not able to heat their homes. They're not able to run air conditioning in the wintertime, or air conditioning in the summertime, I should say. And so the elderly are the ones, for example, who die every year because they don't have adequate air conditioning. So all of these things have unintended consequences. And when it comes to terrorism, there was one cell alone in New York City that was busted. They had made $30 million by themselves, one small little terrorist cell, trucking packs of cigarettes from Virginia and North Carolina to New York City. So you think of all of the millions of terrorists out there and the money that they have collected from this. There was one study that just came out just as Thaler was preparing to get his Nobel Prize, actually, from the American Enterprise Institute, that found that about a third of smokers willingly buy illegal cigarettes on the black market. If you think of all of that money and the amount of it that ends up in the hands of terrorism, we really need to rethink our policy.
Ben, so let's talk about these policies, and they impact families, and there is definitely a moral component to this. Does anything positive come out of this morally?
Well, again, the intention is always the best. And I want to make clear that when we're dealing about this, what we're talking about is the outcome, not,
mm-hmm. Okay.
not the well-meaning intention of those who engage or support this policy. Again, I have no brief for smoking or drinking or any of these kinds of activities. I think that human beings are much better off not to do so, and that, in fact, becoming addicted has spiritual consequences,
mm-hmm.
as well.
I agree.
So you know, it shortens the amount of time you have to serve the Lord. It takes away your vitality during the years that you have, especially at the end, to serve the Lord. So all of these things are harmful. But this is not the way to do it. And when the government's involved in this, it creates certain strange economic and moral issues for the government. For example, I'm old enough to remember the state that I grew up in had what were called state stores that sold hard liquor. If you wanted to buy hard liquor, you had to go to the state store, I'm told. I didn't personally go there myself, but you would go there. Which means that now the government is actually involved in the thing that it's telling you is immoral. The government, it says, don't do this, and now
yeah.
the government is the one actively selling it. So Uncle Sam turns into Uncle Sam Malone, the bartender. Cheers. But yeah, and then the government, when it taxes, becomes dependent on that money, and then it has an incentive to encourage the behavior that it's trying to discourage through taxing, because now it has a source of revenue. And then big government itself, of course, is a moral hazard, in my opinion. But
well, you're going to make a huge donation to Faith Radio and bring fresh comedy to the show. So this is win-win for me.
I do what I can do. Some people would argue my entire career has been one big joke.
All right, Ben, what are your thoughts on some of the proposed tax changes here in the U.S.?
This tax policy, I think, has a lot of good components to it. Lowering the corporate tax to make us more internationally competitive, mm-hmm. I think, would be a major help, particularly for single proprietors or for those who, for the most part, file as though their business is on their personal tax, so they end up paying a different tax rate than others. That's harmful. Generally, the less money that people have to give up in taxation means that they're able to spend it, and when people spend it on what they value or when they save it, and of course we've had sort of a war on savings with our ultra-low interest rates for decades now, where the Federal Reserve's trying to goose the economy by juicing up as much incentive as possible to spend. If people wish to save, they get punished in that. So when people make their own economic decisions, the market always comes out ahead. It's when the government believes that they know best and they try to direct us in some way that things are more harmful. So lower taxes generally are very favorable. My concern is that I don't think you're going to get a lot of bipartisan support for certain measures. And it makes you wonder if they're going to be able to bring this across the finish line. I certainly hope that the better proposals, particularly, again, corporate rates, are something that are going to see the light of day.
And you also think that the regulations that are being lifted or replaced every time, I think President said there's a new regulation brought in, two have to go, that's probably boosting the confidence of a lot of small business owners and people maybe reluctant to grow their business.
I think that's one of the best things that President Trump has done on his own. This had an international impact. There are other nations that have had similar rules in the past, but I'm glad that he's brought it to this country. It's called a one in, two out, where for every regulation that is written, two regulations have to be repealed. And you know, the United States regulatory code is multiple times longer than the Bible. These are rules that are written by unelected officials, these permanent government bureaucrats. No one writes, for the most part, these rules are not voted upon. They're simply encoded by people who work in the bureaucracy. And so there's a democratic issue, which is actually the article we're going to have here just in a few moments on ACT in Transatlantic, dealing with the moral component of unelected bureaucrats writing regulations and what moral teaching has to say about that. But that's an issue in itself. And then just the power of the regulatory state costs billions of dollars. The Competitive Enterprise Institute here in Washington has done an amazing job of showing exactly what a drag on the economy these regulations are. We could have the sort of growth that we had during the 1980s if we were able to repeal the most onerous of these regulations. And, of course, the worst regulation, I'm glad to see, is being gutted a little bit, but it's still in effect to some degree, and that's, of course, the HHS mandate for birth control and abortifacients.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I want to just give all of our listeners a place where they can go read your writing. Is it acton.org, A-C-T-O-N? Is that the best place to go?
Yeah, acton.org, and when you're there, go to the Transatlantic webpage. It's acton.org/publications/transatlantic, TransAtlantic, like the Atlantic Ocean.
Okay.
We deal with things going on in the United States, Canada, and Europe.
Nice, and you can see two articles that Ben has written, one on the nudge and the separated families, and one on the way in which some of the sin taxes have benefited terrorism. If you want to get more information on those two articles, head over to acton.org, A-C-T-O-N.org. Ben, thanks so much for coming on the show. Look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, and God bless.
God bless, Ben. It is 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break. We've got Ron Deal coming up. Get your phones out if you have questions on your blended family. We're going to talk about placing your spouse in the front seat of your heart. Be back in a minute.
up, put on a happy face.
It's 32 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a little break for news. On this day in 1901, Daredevil Anna Edson Taylor became the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. She emerged from the 175-foot fall without any injuries. Good for her. I think I'll pass on that little experiment. We'll be back in just a minute. We're going to talk to Ron Deal from Family Life Blended at 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Be right back.
Wipe off that full of doubt. Look, slap on a happy grin.
It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. God designed each of us to need one another. Dr. John Townsend describes the need for community and what it looks like to be connected to others.
The neuroscience backs up what the Bible's been saying for thousands of years. We were meant to be a community where we meet their needs and they meet our needs. And if you turn to 1 Peter 4:10, it's one of my favorite passages. It says, we are the stewards of God's manifold grace. All right, if we're the stewards of His grace, that means that people are the delivery system of grace to each other. So it's not just get the goodies from God and then go help everybody else. Get the goodies from God. Get the goodies from other people. Be vulnerable. Tell people, I need to vent today. Can I take you to coffee and just kind of vent about my crummy day? Or I've been beating myself up because I screwed up on the Smith account. Or I wasn't a very good wife today, and I need you to talk to me about it. We need to need each other just like we need to need God. That's community.
That's interesting. If you want to hear more of that interview from Dr. John Townsend, who is a psychologist and author, head over to MyFaithRadio.com and type in John Townsend, Overcoming Entitlement. You might get to that full interview. You can hear it. We will now take a very short break, and when we come back, Ron Deal from Family Life Blended will be with us. So get your phone ready if you have questions for Ron. We're going to talk about placing your spouse in the front seat of your heart. Be back in a minute.
I've met parents who post a list of rules on the fridge and expect kids to fall in line. But more often than not, that piece of paper does nothing more than annoy and embarrass the kids. And frankly, it doesn't work. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. In the teen years, nothing's more important than developing relationships between parents and kids, because rules without a relationship causes rebellion. So here's what I suggest. Take time to get with your teen over breakfast or dinner or coffee, and do it every week. Over time, you'll find this weekly get-together will be a place to share your own stories, your own faults, even a place where your teen will talk about deeper concerns. You'll be surprised how rules take care of themselves once there's a relationship.
Find more help from Mark Gregston at ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Good morning. It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Every time I have Ron Deal on, I always get a very strong cup of coffee. I get my notebook out, my pen in hand, take my shoes off. Wait, who am I kidding? My shoes are never on when I'm in the studio. And I learn because Ron has so much to teach. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
We're good. I want to let all of our listeners know, if you have a question for Ron about a blended family, give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. I want to start our conversation off this morning, Ron, talking about I think an article you wrote about placing your spouse in the front seat of your heart. When you start a blended family, the family, the marriage, the foundation, step families are at a disadvantage, aren't they?
Well, you know, things just start a little upside down, and the structure can be a liability unless couples recognize what's going on and are very intentional about it. We've all heard of couples. Let's talk about a first marriage situation, mom and dad raising their kids. We've all heard of, seen, been aware of, maybe it's even happened to you, that when the kids come along, you kind of give your marriage away to the children. I mean, we all know that can happen, right? So one of the things we talk about is protect your marriage through the child-rearing years. It's easy to get caught up in their schedules and give all of your emotional energy and attention to the kids and what they need, and you kind of lose track with one another. And then you wake up one day in the empty nest and you go, who are you? I haven't seen you in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all know that can happen in a first marriage situation. In a blended family home, you kind of start that way. right? It was parent, single parent, and children. Whatever the story is before that, it varies, but you basically come into the family with single parent and children, a tight emotional bond, connectedness, family. There, it's your kids. You've been in the foxhole of life together. You've survived some difficult things together. And now we're bringing in a new partner, and the marriage is in effect added on to the end of the children, if you will. That just inherently creates an opportunity for kids to be more important than the marriage. And fundamentally, putting your spouse in the front seat of your heart is saying, now we have to make another shift in this family unit. We have to make a shift to where the marriage is, in effect, what guides the home, not my relationship with my kids. Now, just saying that out loud, I always want to wrap around the other side, Bill, because I know some people hear me say that, and what they hear is, I want you to neglect your children, right? That is not what I'm saying. That is clearly not what I'm saying. In a first marriage, you know, couples definitely give a lot of their time and energy to their children. You balance that, your marriage relationship and your parenting at what's required there. Same thing is going to happen in a blended family, but you just have to recognize that you started out behind the ball, so to speak, and you have to figure out a way to make your marriage be a functional priority within the home so that you lead and guide as a marital unit, and that you don't have any chinks in your armor that can be easily divided.
Ron, what about when the relationship starts, and as you move into this marriage, the kids are all of a sudden now got lots of issues and concerns, and we're supposed to make the spouse the priority, but the priority really needs to go to the kids who are suffering maybe for reasons unbeknownst?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question, and that's reality. Is there really is a both and here. It is both your marriage and your children. It's not, you're not neglecting them, walking away from them, abandoning them. You are still going to invest in them. In fact, one of the paradoxes that I try to help couples and blended families recognize is that when a biological parent in a step family moves toward their children in the early years of the family, and what I mean by that, moves toward them in the sense of, you know, carving out some one-on-one time and making sure that they continue to keep up some of those little rituals. Johnny and I used to go throw the football together. Well, you know, we haven't done that in months. Well, it's time to get the football out, right? You know, go rediscover those connecting points with your children. Why? Because they need to know they haven't lost you to the marriage. Now, they've lost a little bit of you. They've lost some of your attention and your time and your energy because you now have a relationship that you've got to invest in. And so there's some reality in that for them. There's some loss in this for them. But they can't lose all of you, and that's the important thing. When you move toward your kids, you actually make it easier to move toward your spouse, if that makes any sense. And ultimately, that helps your children move toward your spouse, their step-parent.
You know, Ron, everything seems to be related to expectations. Should a couple moving into a blended family marriage just expect to have an extended period of bonding and connecting because day one, you step into a fairly chaotic family situation?
Yeah, well, yeah, and not necessarily chaotic, but it can take left turns on you that you didn't anticipate. So, yes, you're right. Expectations are this can take a while. And let me just put layers onto that, because in one sense, you wouldn't get married if you didn't have some sense that, hey, the relationships are working. You know, my new or my future spouse is getting along with my kids and they seem to like him or her and, you know, things are going along pretty well. And so, yeah, let's get married, right? But there's so many adjustments that need to take place when you move in together and you begin to live life together and you got new rules and you're trying to figure out holiday traditions. And there's just a merging process that does take time. And with that merging process, relationships that seem to be going well sometimes take a step backwards. And so, yeah, time is a really important thing. I think we've talked before on this program. The average blended family needs somewhere between 5 and 7 years to settle all of those questions about who are we and how are we going to be family now. That's an extended period of time that most people just don't think it's going to take that long. That's average. That's typical. Some families do it faster than that. Some take longer than that.
Yeah.
The point is, this is a process. And you've got to leave some flex and adjustment period and and not pressure everybody to just get along right out of the chute. They have to figure this out, like you have to figure this mm-hmm. out. So cut yourself a break. It's one of the things we say to people.
Yeah.
You'll get there. Just keep going.
Yeah, Ron, I'm going to take a break. When I come back, I've got some tips that you put in this article. I want to kind of run through those kind of quickly. And I also want to take any calls that someone might have for Ron Deal, 877-933-2484. We'll get your question to Ron, or you can also email me, bill@myfaithradio.com, if you don't want to come on the air. You just want me to ask the question. We'll take a break. It's 14 minutes until the top of the hour. Be right back with Ron Deal.
It's like, baby, it's something that we love to see. Every time we hear the music.
Good morning. It's 11 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Ron Deal from Family Life Blended. And we're talking about setting up some foundational tips as blended families start their relationship together. Ron, you say setting up a night to be together is important. Prioritize for it and keep it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I mean, date nights are important, whether you're first marriage or second or third or whatever the case is.
Sure.
That's a part of nurturing that relationship. But, you know, something else that goes along with that is – imagine a step parent who says out loud, you know, just within earshot of the children, of their stepchildren, who says to their spouse, hey, listen, make sure you get some time with your kids this weekend. What the step parent is essentially saying to the children, they're talking to their spouse, but the kids are overhearing it. So they're also sending a message to the kids that says, I'm not in competition with you, and I respect and honor your relationship with your parent, and that is a good thing. And I'm glad you guys need to get some time together with me out of the picture for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That is a little bit of a gift, and it helps the kids go, oh, okay, you know, it's not me versus you. It's we all just have to share, my parent, your spouse, and this is a part of us being family now. Over time, that sort of repeated message helps to take the threat, if that's the right word, out of the, you're here trying to take my mom away from me sort mm-hmm. of feeling kids may have.
Yeah. Okay. What about striving to trust the heart of your spouse? Assume your spouse has goodwill toward your children, even if they complain.
Yeah, this is important. Let me tell you, there's a trap here that I think a lot of biological parents slip into without even really realizing what's going on. God set up a two-parent system, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. We're supposed to help each other. We're supposed to talk into one another's parenting. But one of the things that really doesn't happen in a first marriage, first family biological situation is when mom says to dad, hey, listen, can I talk to you about something you just said to our kids? You know, I'd like to – can we revisit how we're going to handle this? You know, you speak into one another's lives, but what mom does not end up doing is questioning dad's motives. She doesn't say, okay, you just put our kid in timeout for 6 months. I think that's a little bit too long. And the reason you did that is you hate our child, right? That just doesn't happen. Mom knows dad's motives. She just questions how he handled it.
Hmm.
In a step family situation, there's a trap for biological parents to add a question about the step parent's motives. Okay, you just said that my child ought to be grounded for 6 months. And you did that because you don't like my kid. That is a dangerous thing to do. My experience is that is really not true. 99.9% of the step-parents I've ever interacted with have great motives towards their stepchildren. The reason they put Johnny in timeout is because they want him to learn a lesson, not because they hate him.
Mm-hmm.
And if a biological parent starts questioning and doubting the heart, the motive of the step-parent, now, all of a sudden, they can't do anything right. It doesn't matter what they do. You will find fault with it. And now we've got a bigger, bigger problem that's going to divide you as a couple fast. So guard against that. Don't let yourself judge their motives too harshly.
Yeah. Now, Ron, we have to, I would imagine, supporting your spouse, and you probably, it's helpful to do it in front of the kids. That way they kind of know that everybody's on the same page, and I can't have a faction where I go, well, you're not my mom, so I'm going to get the answer from my dad. You can't.
Yeah.
You have to allow both parents to be empowered, don't you?
Exactly, exactly. And this is especially true with a step-parent who's trying to find their way in and develop their place in the home. Imagine mom comes home at the end of the workday and the first thing she hears from little Susie is, your husband told me I couldn't go down the street and play with my friend because I had to do my homework. You know, he's such an awful, horrible person, mom. And if mom says to her little Susie, you're right, he shouldn't have done that. We have just made it 10 times harder for stepdad to play any role in Susie's life, right? You've got to try to support him. Now, it's okay if you disagree. Sometimes you will disagree about how something was handled, but do your best in front of the children to support each other. You can come back around and say, you know what? And I would say if she really doesn't like how stepdad handled that, you go talk to stepdad privately, have a conversation. And stepdad and mom come back to Susie together and say, you know what, we've talked about this and we're going to handle it a little bit differently than what I said earlier. But you're still a united front. Stepdad's the one who's taking the lead on this change. You know, clearly there's been a dialogue there. It's okay to change midstream what you've decided to do, but don't undercut each other in front of the kids.
Mm. Ron, what happens when there's just different discipline styles coming from different families? I mean, isn't it... doesn't that get dangerous? I mean, maybe one person came from a military-style family and the other family came from a Woodstock-style family. So yeah. What happens when there's just a different style? Do we honor that spouse who's, boy, I wouldn't do it this way, but I know their history, so therefore I have to honor the way they're doing it? Or what happens in those situations?
I think the key words are talk and negotiation. I mean, you've got to find unity together. Same thing happens in a first marriage, right? You can have two totally different parenting styles, but the difference is you're figuring this out before the child has any awareness. You know, the kid's zero, age zero when they're, you know, and at the age of one, you're beginning to figure out, hey, you see things differently than I. So kids are not aware of it. When you come into a step family, they may have lived under a system for 10, 15, 20 years sometimes, and now things are changing. Well, that's just a harder adjustment to make, but the principle is the same. You as a parent and step-parent have to find some measure of unity, which means you got to negotiate. How are we going to handle it? You see it this way, I see it that way. We've got to figure out what the us answer is. And I, you know, Bill, this is the hard thing about parenting. I got to tell you, it's not easy. I mean, Nan and I have certainly had disagreements and we've had things that we just didn't see the same. And you know, what I thought would be a 10-minute conversation turns out to be a couple of months of dialogue and conversation and talking to friends, and we need outside input, and we got to read a book. And, you know, it's not easy coming together and finding unity, but that principle is so important.
Mm-hmm. Ron, we're in the final minute here of Jeopardy, so you'll need to answer this in the form of a question. But when you're moving your spouse into the front seat of your life, and you're doing that, but the child is feeling left behind. And what do you do in that situation?
I come back to what we said earlier. The biological parent does need to move toward their child. Not exclusively, but as balance to moving the spouse into the front seat. You do need to give your kid some time. You do need to listen to what they're feeling. You do need to have an investment of one-on-one time, exclusive, without step-siblings or step-parent in the picture. Why? Because you got to feed that child's heart. You got to respond. You got to let them know that they have not completely lost you. Finding the balance is not always easy, but that's the principle that we're going to go for.
Mm-hmm. Ron, you're always so smart and so clear. I appreciate that. I know our listeners love it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yep. It is 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and then wrap up the big show in just a minute. That wraps up the big show. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. I'm going to leave you with the verse we started with, Nehemiah 8:10, that says, "The joy of the Lord is my strength." And we're going to tweet that out. I want you to think about that throughout your whole day. The joy of the Lord is my strength. Go there regularly throughout your day if you're feeling a little bit blue. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe
to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.